Phil. So the second half, I thought we'd look at disease states and forward engineering this cancer treatment. A problem nature has, now I see in this case disease, going back to our engineering analogy, is an error in manufacturing. Of course we can have failure of...
I was having a discussion with some of the other participants at the refreshments about sickle cell. And there's sort of two ways you can view sickle cell. You can also view sickle cell as a solution.
I'll mention
to an evolutionary problem as well.
So we'll see that, you know, I view disease in this engineering sense as an error in manufacturing. You know, when we used to get those plastic toys from Hong Kong, and they just basically replaced the metal part with the plastic part, and it broke on Christmas Day, you know. So that's one error in manufacturing, is the wrong material in the wrong place with the wrong properties. But also, disease, to me now, in this thinking, would be environmental degradation and toxins that change composition, structure, its property, and therefore perform. And then I'll show you another 10, 12, 13 years of work associated with developing an anti-cancer drug delivery system based on a bio-inspired solution, which was essentially the red cell membrane. So, you know, nature's ability to encapsulate material provided at least an inspiration for drug delivery. So, we can just relax and you can read this. Changes that occur in sickle cell disease at all scales, if we can, to now understand the macro consequences. So we go back to, you know, defining the function, identifying the altered components. So sickle cell anemia, an inherited condition, some erythrocytes are malformed. We know the hemoglobin polymerizes, forming long strands where the oxygen is very low. Some crescent shapes, sickle blood can't squeeze through the blood vessels, and then the outcome is, blockage of vascular system. But look, kidney infections, chest pain, arms, legs, death, decayed tissues, joints. You know, it's a serious thing when a cell blocks up capillaries. And of course, there's peripheral vascular disease, you know, which wounds are awful in some of these people, but just the blood is not being pumped around, say the leg or the foot or whatever, and these wounds appear. So again, there's more details about sickle cell disease in the appendix. There's a lot more in this appendix. There's probably as many slides in the appendix as there are in the talk here. So if we look at the bow tie hierarchy again, we've seen this, and so now we're focusing on the nanomolecular component, the change in the cell, and then the change to some extent in the person. So what changes in composition, structure, properties, as well as process and performance? So the changes in composition are that this globin, this is one of the units in hemoglobin, has 141 amino acids in the alpha chain, 146 in the beta chain, and if we look at that whole scheme here, then the sixth position changes from glutamic acid for the chemist. So here's a negative charge, at least an OH minus, the O minus, a neutral pH, changes to this. So, you know, anybody dealing with surfaces or materials, making salad dressing, knows that when you go from a water loving to a hydrophobic material, something could change. Now, if that change was anywhere else in this molecule, it might not match at all. But we'll see that this substitution of a polar charged side chain for a nonpolar side chain changes the nanostructure, because it turns out that that glutamic acid, this isn't working, oh yeah, the glutamic acid was in this position, and it's at the top and bottom, and with a little twist, this stuff ends up as a polymer. And so in low oxygen concentration, rather than it being like this and just going from red to blue, the iron, then it goes from red to polymerized blue. And so these hydrophobic interactions now are enough to loosely attach these polymers together into this polymer chain. So that's one of the underlying compositional change that changes the structure of hemoglobin, i.e. from a solution to a polymer. And at the micro scale, they bundle. And so polymers of deoxygenated sickle hemoglobin molecules, now each one represented by a sphere, which then polymerizes in this twisted out of the helical bundle. And the polymers grow from nucleation sites and produce these star-shaped cells. So, you know, we've got a rigidity of a polymer now, which is as a result of just a hydrophobic interaction. So, like I said, if that hydrophobic interaction was anywhere else in this molecule, then it might not have mattered. Just like a lot of other genetic changes in proteins could be anywhere else in the molecule and they don't matter. So we only see the ones that matter in genetic diseases when they occur in the binding pocket or part of the receptor or something like that. So lots of the protein is really, as far as the hemoglobin is concerned, much of that protein is just so that the heme sits in a pocket. And it's not influencing necessarily the heme pocket, it's influencing more this polymerization. But in some of these cases, apparently the heme does dissociate and now becomes an oxidizing unit in the cell. Anyway, so changes in performance then of this product. You know, we're expecting red cells to traverse the circulation, you know, 4 times a minute for 120 days. And then with increase in and decrease in oxygen, this sickling cycle goes through. We get the depolymerization cycle, and then the membranes actually become more rigid. So it's not just the polymer in here. Also, there's some rigidity of membrane. I'll show you Evans' experiments in this in a minute. So what are the changes in properties? So if you look at the biology book, and I, you know, you Google and you just pull this stuff down offline. This is what they said about sickle cell anemia. These rigid polymers distort the cell that cause it to bend after shape. Sickle hemoglobin are held together by weak forces. The abnormal valine interacts weakly. The complex twisting interactions, cross interactions, weak. Sounds like mechanics. So the biologists have got all this right, but we just haven't put any quantity on it. And so our task as physical chemists, mechanical engineers, physicists, or physical, you know, people that are dealing with models, would be to actually quantify some of this stuff. So what Evan and Mohandas Nala did, and this is a website for it. I should have this is the abstract. I think I have the paper. But what they did was these micropipette aspiration tests on single cells, and show the static rigidity of the membrane shear modulus now. So this is the property that measures the shear modulus of oxygenated sickle cells increase with increasing hemoglobin concentration, whereas the rigidity of normal cells was independent of hemoglobin concentration. So they took cells and they replaced the hemoglobin concentration in a cell and got the same modulus. And then they took sickle cells and they changed the hemoglobin concentration, and it was a function of that hemoglobin concentration. So there's here's a few minutes of a video that Evan lent me from, it comes up on his, so this is that aspiration experiment that you've seen, and maybe I'll move it along a little bit, but it, you know, basically it does go up in this projection length, probably the time to show this. It's a, you know, very gentle world when you're doing these mechanical experiments. So each one, each video frames, keep jumping obviously between these suction pressures. So they went up to the to a limit which was below the buckling limit, and then they show the elasticity. So this is again a 1 micron pipette or so, showing the elastic. That's what you wanted to see. So obviously this elastic has got to go back. You know. And then this is the aspiration of a sickle cell. So he's measuring the suction pressures on here. And these are static, you know, measurements. So another aspect of this might be you'd have to do tens to 20, 30, 40 cells to get averages and different people. And so there's a lot of statistics going into this, you know, that, like we've talked about, you know, cancer being one in a million cells, it doesn't show up in the normal distribution. So single cells or single measurements, physics and chemistry and analyses at a single cell level to make this this kind of thing meaningful.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So it was my impression that with sickle cells, the problem was that they didn't carry oxygen as well.
That's
right.
Correct.
So do these, is it a consequence of direct consequence of the shape, or the what is the reason they can't transport?
I think the chemically, I think they also lose some of the heme.
They lose the heme.
I think there's some of the, because as you'll see, some of the damage that's done here is oxidative damage. So some of the heme is lost, and that goes to the membrane, because when Evan does these experiments, he did switch sickle hemoglobin into normal cells, and normal hemoglobin into sickle cells, and got what you might expect, that it was the hemoglobin doing the damage, not just the sickle polymer. Because, I mean, again, it's a complicated story, you know, and I'd also say that even though we know all this, and this was done in the 80s, it's not been cured because we've been able to fix it at the molecular level, or the cellular level. So this is extension recovery in sickle cells. This is that double pipette experiment. So if you have this flowing around your bloodstream, I think the person who might have done these experiments could have been Andrew Leung. He's been with Evan for 20, 25 years now. He's a real expert at this micromanipulation stuff. And they did it on an old computer. So that's the extension ratio, and they obviously extended the sickle cell a little bit more, and that's its slow recovery. And then this is that unfolding, you know, hot dog bun, bend and stretch. So in this, you know, we're looking at shear and bend, and not necessarily the area dilation. And you can guess what happens here. And the liver. The
right.
liver, the liver is even smaller. There's sinusoids in the liver that are even smaller than the capillary.
So even if the hemoglobin was functioning perfectly,
yeah.
everything else the same, they'd still have a hard time.
Yeah. So that's the, you know, whatever, 1 second recovery.
And yeah, well, for the sickle cell, the liquid inside is still Newtonian or no?
Well, no, it's a polymer now.
You're looking at a volume response and a surface response, the combination?
Both, yeah. And so Evan was trying to tease out the membrane response out of this. So the next slides after this will be. So yeah, the next slide here. So when he did this reconstitution of normal and sickle, so normal membranes with normal hemoglobin, that's the number you get. And then if you go to normal membranes with sickle hemoglobin, the shear modulus went up. And if you go to sickle membranes with normal hemoglobin, it went down. And so the influence of the sickle hemoglobin now, you know, is teased out as a what he thinks is the interaction of sickle hemoglobin with the cell membrane is responsible for augmented static rigidity of these erythrocytes. That's the paper in 1987.
And
the other
like GUV is polymers inside, you know,
we haven't done that, but you know, but now you know, it's more. I think it's going to be a lot more complicated. Sure, if you want, there's models of static polymers with some kind of elasticity and viscosity themselves. But Evan was trying to find the membrane. I mean, these are normal membranes with sickle hemoglobin, and then sickle membranes with normal hemoglobin. So it's you know, he was looking at the oxidation and the membrane problem. All right, so the learning objective here was how to use this design methodology in order to reverse engineer problem nature has and look at really the changes, composition, structure, properties, processing of molecules, membranes, and cells, and why the changes in function. And then there's malaria. And there's an appendix, you know, got a whole series of slides on this in the appendix of how this, these cells that are infected with this parasite sickle much more readily. And because they sickle more readily, they're removed by the liver and spleen. So only if you have a sickle trait. If you have sickle cell disease, you die of sickle cell disease. Even if there's malaria around. If you don't have sickle cells, then you die of malaria. But if you have half and half, if you have the sickle trait, one parent, then you survive because the red cells are removed by the liver and spleen and removes the burden. And then this oxygen radical formation in the sickle trait erythrocyte retards the growth of the parasite in the red cells. So the parasite can't survive that much in the red cell itself. So there's a again, this is the problem nature solved with a problem that it had. And you look at the malarial band across the equator, and it matches the sickle cell band. Actually, the same places up in the mountains, they don't have it. And so that didn't get preserved, because there's no parasites up there, no mosquitoes. So if we look at denaturation, then changes in composition and structure that change properties can be, you know, genetic, but they can also be, you know, involves materials that are added. So if obviously, if we add detergents to membranes, then they can be affected. They can be affected. If we add alcohol, that can affect the composition, structure, and performance of nerve membranes. If we add, you know, other anesthetics, that does that. Denaturation of proteins disrupt a shear rigid structure, so occupational exposure, like a set of CS2, causes neurological, hepatic, and cardiovascular changes, and then experiments with rats, 40-day exposure, cause erythrocytes cross-linking and change the shear modulus. You have to change the shear modulus 25%, and only change the spectrum cross-linking by 8%. So our mechanical analysis was more sensitive to changes than the chemical analysis, and then there's heat. And without saying too much, this is what happens when you heat red cells. Protein falls apart, the membranes start to bud. Things we were talking about last week about how lipid bilayers are unstable when they don't have the shear rigid network, they start to bud like this. So there's more, again, more details in the appendix on this kind of thing. So if I switch now to my forward engineering example, so in the last 30 minutes or so, just look at this bio-inspired solution to an anti-cancer drug delivery problem. What I call now a new paradigm for local drug delivery using temperature-triggered release of drug from liposomes for these anti-tumor applications. And I've got, you know, again, a list of acknowledgments at the end, and here are some up front. Postdocs, Mark Dewhurst is a collaborator, Fan Yuan. So did everybody see the Wall Street Journal this morning? You missed that or something? Here's the nano soccer ball kicks cancer into touch Monday, March 27th by this well-known science writer, Ino Rickerson. So this is my abstract, but you know, I sometimes use it at meetings just see if people are still awake. And but this is
you
believe
you know.
You believe where can I invest? Yeah, so this is what we're gonna talk about, how liposomes coming through the bloodstream, you know, go out into the tumor and the blood vessels are destroyed. So that's where we'll end up.
You changed the date every week up.
Yeah.
Today, 27 March, so I don't know if you changed the date to that date.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at this kind of thing.
But he had that in the idea, so don't think about
yeah,
it being the joke. Yeah.
I'll teach you how to do this if you want. So the nano soccer ball then, maybe even a nano medicine. And so this is a actual picture of a faceted liposome. So immediately the physicists and you know, people involved in mechanics maybe will say, all right, how does this faceted structure appear in something only this size? And we'll get to that. This is a waxy membrane, 2 molecules thick. Here might be our cartoon of the lipid bilayer. And here's my kind of soccer ball morphology that I talked about. So so this is inspired by nature's encapsulation technology then. So if we just look at our, maybe try and create a bow tie hierarchy for this. We want to actually be able to inject something in somebody with prostate cancer. And, you know, the cancer might have blood vessels that wind around it and supply it with blood. And so the problem is to take this cancer cell, how to get drugs to the cancer cell, and possibly the endothelia via the bloodstream without it disappearing to the liver and spleen. And a drug that binds the DNA and will destroy it. That's the problem. And so the cure, or the answer that I came up with was to build on 25 years of liposome research and 20,000 papers and 300 patents and 4 companies and 2 products, and just tweak it. Like, who's from BASF? Who's talking about that? You know, we don't build it, we don't make it, we just make it better. You know, that kind of thing. So I just tweaked the composition here that changed the structure of the membrane, changed the properties of the membrane, and changed its performance. And so now we end up with a drug being leaking out in this tumor, puts cells into apoptosis or kills them, and your grandfather spends more time than his granddaughter because all the tumors disappear. So we'll show you that. So here's a problem nature has. And what strategies could we use to treat this? Well, let's reverse engineer the tissue cell, reverse engineer the cancer cell, what changes in composition, structure, properties, and process of all components promote its altered function and uncontrolled growth. So that's where you might want to spend some time. And you can get this out of any, catalog on these molecules that tell you where all the networks are going in signal transduction. Maybe a magic bullet that reverses the process or moves it to another state. Of course, we don't have that yet, but we have drugs that will do damage to cells in culture, and the problem is how to do that in the body. We want to understand the disease progression, the extent it can be prevented. So here's a cancer cell invading and all the rest of the things that happen. Or we can cut it out. So we can understand all this and come up with something. Of course, we've understood all this in order to do this too. This is the best you can do at the moment. Cut it out, blast it with radiation, or kill it with chemotherapy. And if you just Google chemotherapy, you end up with, you know, stories of kids that are on chemotherapy, and these are worth reading. So, you know, you don't need to motivate this too much, but here's an application: cancer incidence and mortality, oral cancers, digestive organs, respiratory. If you smoke, then not much chance there. 1.22 million new cases worldwide. This is in 2000. Most common are lungs, stomach, breast, and then colorectal, uterine, and cervix cancers. So the clinical motivation, if you want to go to clinicaltrials.gov, you can see all the clinical trials that are going on. In fact, if I did this, I motivated a chapter that I just wrote for a book on nanotechnology and cancer therapeutics. And so I went to clinicaltrials.gov and I put in cancer, and 4,776 trials came up. I put in chemotherapy, and about 1,700 came up, and I put in liposomes, and 20 came up. So there's 20 trials out of 4,700 that are using liposomes, which is the quintessential drug delivery system at the moment. So there's lots of room for nanotechnology now to be involved in real drug delivery. So, you know, you say, well, why would you want to do this? Well, even though a tumor is local and failure to control the growth of the primary, regional, or, say, ovarian, pancreatic, brain cancers can result in significant illness as well as death of patients. It's not necessarily just a result of metastases. And anybody with cancer, they won't have it cut out or the radiation. One half of patients treated by local therapist treatment fails. Of course, there's successes in breast cancer. There are successes in childhood leukemias with chemotherapy. But cancers of importance might be cervix, pancreas, colorectal, ovarian, even breast and prostate. So I have some motivation here. Here's a little personal side. My mother, this was an article that was in a newspaper locally, and it says about this grandmother. She had cancer twice. In 1972, she had one breast cancer, which was taken off, and then she had this party and she raised some money for the Genesis appeal. These are people now looking at preventative medicine, and so there's an area where you might want to start to couple up with biologists, is in preventing disease and understanding these mechanisms whereby the body heals itself and enhancing that rather than coming in afterwards and just carving things up and then, you know, be able to live fun and go home. So. So she's fine. I mean, you know, she's had cancer twice. She survived a second breast cancer. She's had a hysterectomy. She's had a heart attack from the cancer drug that they gave her. Was it on a trial? And she's still cooking along, going to hospital, visiting people. And anyway, so that's my story. So the overall statement then is a pervading vascular system with tumor in the prostate, and the prostate enlarges, and the tumor might be on the edge somewhere, and so can we treat that? And again, there are more details about prostate cancer, its prevalence, how it's going down a little bit. There's also a few slides on a chat line for cancer patients, and they were sharing their story of how drugs make their tongue rough and fungus, and just a ton of little things that, you know, just give you an idea of what it is to be on chemotherapy. So kill it with chemo then. A drug works in culture, so now we're looking at design. So we're going through this list of what do we choose. Let's choose doxorubicin. So this is a drug that's too toxic to inject in the bloodstream at concentrations high enough to kill tumors in the body. That's the problem. The unmet need then is some kind of bloodstream delivery, the drug to the tumor, less toxic side effects, reduced tumor size, maybe even to zero. Of course, the.
Oh, is this an intercalator? I mean, how does it work in one tenant?
Yeah, it's two things. It intercalates into the DNA, but it also is a strong oxide radical, or produces free superoxide. So, again, the mechanism is not fully understood, but if you spill it on your skin, it just eats your skin. So it's a you know, nasty molecule, and it works in micromolar concentrations too. You've got 5 liters of blood, how much do you need in the body? If you go to over microliters, then everything starts to go wrong. So that's the problem.
How much is the dose, you know? Like one of these super $1,000 per pill.
No, yeah, it's an old, cheap drug.
This is an old drug,
yeah.
Off patent,
yeah.
And everything. But it's just nasty.
Very nasty, but very effective.
Yeah, so if we look at our scheme then, we change this now from a component to carry oxygen to a component to carry and release drugs in tumors. And we would go through this whole process. Of course, we didn't do this over 25, 30 years, but a little hindsight, you know, analysis, I'll try and do a little bit of this, and some of it will be in the appendix. So Nature's encapsulation technology was to encapsulate life and other life chemistries like hemoglobin in controlled chemical, physical, biological environment by creating the biological cell. And, you know, you might ask, yourselves, how would you now, knowing what we know about membranes, use nature's solutions to encapsulate and inspire drug delivery systems for anti-cancer treatment? How could we use lipids to form drug enclosing capsules? And back to our methodology, so let's describe this unmet need and define the function. So the required functions of a carrier system are to do this, and they've been involved with tumor, and we want to do this injection. And you know, it appeared a long time ago that we knew from the 70s, you know, liposomes were kind of created in 1965. Alec Bangman was looking at membranes as a model for cells and understanding membrane permeability. Dennis Hayden at the same time made these black lipid films, and they were both in Cambridge. I ended up working with Dennis for a while. Load and retain drug in some submicroscopic capsule, and even early on, when they injected liposomes into the bloodstream, the liver and spleen just took these things out. The opsonization, everything we know about foreign particles now in the bloodstream, they get opsonized and they're removed. So how do you evade the body's immune defenses to give it a chance to reach wherever the tumor is in the body? So injection, within a few minutes, they end up in the liver and spleen, first pass. So you might even think about targeting tumors specifically. We know a lot about nature's specific, you know, antibody-antigen interactions. Can you do something like that, targeting tumor antigens, and then release of drugs in tumors? So we've got a paper on that. Possible inspirational systems then. So we want to choose something biocompatible. Materials for components of lipids, sugars, amino acids, nucleotides, synthetic materials like polymers or composites. We want free drug. Macromolecules like polymers, maybe. Maybe lipoprotein particles would be kind of neat, or proteins themselves. Membrane-bound capsules, cells, liposomes. Maybe Dennis Disher will come and talk about his polymersomes. These liposomes do the same thing, so we choose liposomes. So the tentative compound design then, size requirements, surface requirements, mechanical requirements. So let's look at those, clinical requirements, drug choice. So the size requirements are the vascular system has these small capillaries that are 5 microns, say, in cardiac muscle. Also in the back of your eye, if you want to see your blood flowing through your eye, I think we talked about this last week, but the ones that weren't here, look over the blue sky and you'll see the white blood cells in the back, just little dots going around. And that's white cells going through the capillaries. In fact, one of the images I'm going to show, a video, will be fluorescently labeled red cells doing the same thing. But anyway, that's the capillary beds, and then there's this sinusoidal kind of transport through the liver. So sinusoids are 2 microns. So you might say, well, anything less than 2 microns or a micron. Well, it turns out that experiments with liposomes show 400 nanometers get taken up in the spleen and less than 80 end up in the liver with a physical kind of mechanism. So people have chosen 100 nanometer liposomes. We want to optimize the circulation time with drug carrying capacity of 1 gram per mole of lipid. 1 microgram per micromole. And if we want to look at the size, then here's that neutrophil that can get through small capillaries by actually unfolding the membrane. And here's the red cell that gets through, as we saw. And then the liposome might be 100 nanometers. So this is 7 microns, and then this is the 100 nanometer. And so that's our tentative component now, if we're engineering this. Kind of simple. So the surface requirements then, the surface will be determined by the head group on the lipids, and we can take neutral phospholipids, and they have a half-life of 30 minutes in the bloodstream. They don't get away from this opsonization. And in fact, if you put negatively charged lipids on, one of the first things people did was, oh, I know a lot about color and chemistry. Let's put negative charges on these things so that they repel each other. Well, they attracted a lot of attention from positively charged proteins. And they ended up in the liver and spleen within a few minutes. So the colloidal version of can we separate things in biology doesn't work because there's positive stuff as well as negative stuff around. And so here are the sinusoids in the liver, and here's a Kupffer cell. If the blood comes through here and liposomes come through, this guy eats it. It's called a macrophage, a big eater. And it recognizes the surface label on the liposome. So people came up with this idea of pegylation. Let's be bio-inspired by the red cell and its polymer layer and create some repulsive potentials associated with a highly hydrated polymer. And that worked. And so now our tentative component design is going to be a polymer, of course, on both sides, but a membrane with a certain amount of this polymer, say at the mushroom level of covering the surface 4 mole percent, 5 mole percent.
How long is your polymer?
How big?
How long? Yes, how
2,000 molecular weight.
2,000?
Yeah. So it's, you know, 35, 47 burrs. So it sticks out about, you know, 35, 40 angstroms. So if you look at the mechanical requirements, and we just do our simple Laplace equation here, then for R is only 50 nanometers, the tensile strength is 10 millinewtons per meter, then we're up around 4 atmospheres to cause it to fail. So we've got osmotic inflation. These liposomes are pretty stable under any kind of pressurization due to osmotic pressure. So, you know, they usually have about half an osmol concentration, so they're, you know, to get these kind of gradients would be difficult. So most lipid compositions will be okay. You know, we've done a lot of experiments on this mechanical experiment with lipids too. So choose phosphatidylcholines, C16, 18 chains, NPC. Some people put cholesterol in here, added strength, reduced permeability, and get this kind of thing. So that's fine. So the choice of drug, we've got lots of drugs maybe. Here's some drugs, and I'll just show donarubicin, doxorubicin, it's in the same family. We might be looking at vincristine, or paclitaxel, or cisplatin. So, you know, drugs that have got a water solubility, but we'll see that the way in which these are loaded are not just passive encapsulation, they're actually actively loaded through the membrane down in pH gradient because they have these, they have a pKa of around 8, so they have charged and uncharged versions, so some of it's membrane soluble. So the drug of choice then again was doxorubicin. This is a little bit on its action. It's an antibiotic used specifically now in cancer treatment. It prevents DNA replication. Exact mechanisms are still not understood, maybe some kind of inhibitor. These are enzymes that temporarily cut one strand of DNA during replication, unbind the double helix. This kind of prevents it. Common side effects are hair loss, mouth sores, nausea, vomiting, lowered blood counts, damage to the heart muscles, skin damage, vein during infusion, kidney effects. So, you know, the early attempts to use this as a drug were compromised by these kind of toxicities. So how do we get drug to a tumor? And I'll show you more of this in a minute. Well, this is in a window chamber and a rat showing the tumor that's grown over a period of 12, 13 days. How do we get this drug to that tumor?
So normally, are they sort of systematically applied?
Yeah, it's a drug. So if we look at our scheme here, analysis of materials performance, detailed specifications of the design, 100 nanometer liposome, circulation half-life, want to specify pegylated lipids, L-alpha phase plus cholesterol lipids to give sufficient strength, retain doxorubicin in this, this liposome. And so now our just building up slowly our component design, it'll be this. So that's great. And here will be a specification, if you like, for it. This is off the IND that was submitted, the pH of the solution, the mean diameter, the osmolarities, the sterility, the appearance, the compositions that were involved. So you want to draw the spec sheet of that that device there. So for production methods, as you all know, if we take lipids and dry them on a surface and swell them, then they can start to come off. There's osmotic pressures from the head grooves. They could be charged. Depends what you use, and we get some kind of multilamellar vesicles. They're squeezed down into single unilamellar vesicles by going through a filter. This is a LiPex extruder. And if you have a 400 nanometer filter, you get about 400 nanometer liposomes, or 200, or 100, or 500, or 50 nanometers. So we can get now, these Peter Cullis and various people in the industry have created liposomes now that are single walled little capsules. Perfect.
There are already little steps.
Yeah. It's probably, if this is 100 plus or minus 20. And then by having these liposomes with a pH 7 outside, 4 inside, the drug is just added and it loads to 9500% given the right mass ratios through the membrane.
So when do you add the PEG?
The PEG's already included in this formulation. You make empty liposomes at pH 4 and then add the doxorubicin, and it goes down its kind of concentration gradients. It's precipitated the inside by citrate. So we can talk more about that. So then prototypes. in vitro testing, drug retention time versus various buffers.
How does the
yeah.
how does the drug get out of this?
Hey,
good question. That's extremely good question. So in vitro testing, drug retention, you know, versus time, what you wanted to show was that the drug stayed in the liposome in the bloodstream because you didn't want to create a toxicity. So that's the problem they solved. It was hard to keep the drug in a liposome, but it doesn't get out when it gets to the tumor. It does get out very slowly, but maybe not fast enough to kill it. I'll show that data later. So it created the right composition, structure properties, related performance. In vitro testing, give a certain amount of drug to the animals, you know, and humans. You want to look at pharmacokinetics, the half-life, the area under the curve, the amount of drug in the bloodstream, volume distribution, where does it go, and then total clearance. So these are some of the things that in prototype testing have all been established, and on the appendix I have a chapter that you can look up that's got all this information for traditional liposomes. So a few other things. So if we now look at what I did with Mark Dewhurst, this stealth liposome appeared. We call it stealth because it avoided the body's defenses for at least a period of time, not as long as the red cell. 24 hours, half-life, not 120 days. But in 1987 it appeared, and in the early 90s there were papers talking about this accumulation in tumors. And so Mark has this testing system. They take a rat or a mouse, and they put a window chamber on its back, and they implant a million tumor cells, and it grows into this tumor within a period of 12 to 15 days. Actually, about the same time it takes a gestation of a mouse to go from an embryo to a full mouse. So here's all the blood vessels. Now these are mouse blood vessels in a human tumor. And so we do have this criteria. These are, again, test bed systems. As we move towards humans, you want to test as much as you can. And so these are normal blood vessels, and this is the tortuosity of the blood vessels that are created by the tumor, their requirement, their angiogenesis, the whole thing that we know about. So it turns out that at the level of the blood vessels here, they're also leaky. And so now we're looking at keeping the stuff in bloodstream long enough for it to leak out through these blood vessels. So the heterogeneous and leaky vasculature is the basis for current liposome delivery. This is the extravasation paradigm, extravascular, you know, accumulation, what we call the EPR effect. Here's a cartoon I just drew last week when the board was full of equations. I was sketching this little cartoon. So here's a mouse in a laboratory, and here's a survival. Of course, all the mice die, you know, because of that. And this old mouse is saying, you know, son, in the old days, cancer was never really our problem. It was always cash. Yeah. So liposome injection. Here's the bright field view from the microscope there. And then this is when we inject fluorescent lipids into the circulation. We can now see in real time where these liposomes go, if you're just looking for delivery now. And this is where they go. The hotspot pattern immediately starts after injection, 90 minutes after we turn the gain on the camera down. And so this leakiness of tumors that you might have heard about is very heterogeneous. And this is as far as the liposomes go. They just get out of the bloodstream. All the black here that you can't see are tumor cells. This is a wart. It's packed full of cells, and the 100 nanometer liposomes don't diffuse that far. If we're thinking physically now about transport, they don't go very far. They stay in what's called the perivascular space. So the hotspot fluorescence now characterizes heterogeneity of the leaky vasculature for this particular tumor. Now there's many, many different types of tumors, and you know, a few other people, Rakesh Jain particularly up at Harvard, they've looked at vasculature, permeability, and this kind of transport. So I said to people that are dealing with liposome, this is where your liposomes go, just into the perivascular space. So if these liposomes release their drug, they would get the cells around here, 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 even though they got out, even though they'd done all the stealth stuff, and they released their drug maybe slowly, you would only get these cells anyway. So liposomes in tumors, this is the stealth liposomes now. This is the bright field image, and then this is the fluorescence image and the leakiness that comes out. These are conventional liposomes. So the ones without the PEG over 90 minutes, 60 minutes, they've gone by the time you do the 60-minute analysis. But these are the stealth liposomes in normal blood vessels in the same window chamber. So you've achieved what you wanted to do. You delivered drug to liposomes, delivered drug to the vasculature, and then out into the vessels, through the vessels of the tumor into the tissue, but normal vessels, they're not that leaky to this 100 nanometer liposome. So you did what you wanted to do, you did do the delivery. And so if we look from a fluorescence analysis, the amount in the bloodstream versus time, and the amount that builds up in the tumor, i.e. the fluorescence we see that's extra over and above what we saw initially, you get this long circulation half-life and you get the buildup in the tumor. If you go with what's called Evacet, the conventional liposome, it drops off very quickly, it doesn't build up in the tumor. Now only 10% of the blood that's going through the heart ends up in any peripheral vascular at all. It all goes through liver, lung, and so there's you already got a reduced chance of getting something to these peripheral vascular sites, like said prostate. And so this would be our, to cut a huge long story short, and there's a lot more of this, here are the liposomes coming through, and the blood vessels are leaking, and they kind of leak out. And that's the EPR effect, but they don't spontaneously release the drug. They're designed to keep the drug and not necessarily release it.
Did you have the data with that control capillary bed?
You saw, I mean, this is kind of, we've got data on capillary beds too, and they're all the same. Actually, this is granulating tissue in the same way.
But presumably, would it degrade over time?
Did you a little bit, and I'll show the data that shows that the drug does get out, and you do get some benefit from that.
And what's the time scale of all that?
A few days, yeah. But how do we improve on Doxil? This is the doxorubicin liposome that comes in this PDG. How do we improve on this? We're getting the drug out, you get an accumulation, but you're not getting cures.
Why do the conventional liposomes leak? I mean, I'm a little confused with conventional liposomes. Because it doesn't have any micropartes and stuff like that.
You don't have any? You don't have any what micropartes?
Macrophages. I mean, when you have just conventional liposomes, they just leak as well as stealth.
They do, but they don't stay long enough in the bloodstream to accumulate in tumor.
Yeah, but you showed an image for these conventional liposomes in the bloodstream.
Showed what? These are conventional ones disappearing from the bloodstream, not building up in the tumor.
I'm confused with the image number two for conventional liposomes.
These are conventional liposomes. The fluorescence is disappearing over a period of time.
Why do they stay inside the vessel? Why don't they leak into the tumor?
Because they're not in high enough concentration to do that. They've gone to the liver and spleen. They've been opsonized. Their circulation half-life is a lot shorter. They're not around. It's a concentration effect.
Yeah.
They're being depleted from the bloodstream, so they're not building up in the tumor. This is all the dynamics of the transport. So, you know, how do we improve on Doxil? And it went something like this. Mark Dewhurst is looking pretty mean here, and he's saying, liposomes aren't working, hypothermia isn't working, I want something I can heat and release, because he's a hypothermia guy. And so I heard what he said, and you know, I'm kind of clueless, dreaming about hiking in England or something. But if we look at the design then, 400 nanometer liposome get taken up, eight by liver, check, 200, check, conventional formulation, we've done this, pegylated liposomes, L alpha phase, sufficient strength, you know, but how do you get the drug out? Still not triggered to release drug, that's the question you're asking. So there's more details on all this as well in the liposomes appendix. So our further development then went load and retain, evade, target, release. A new function would be release now. All this has been achieved, but drug release hasn't. And so how to trigger release in tissues would require, say, new materials or radically new design. And because we've got an $18 million hypothermia program across the road from where I am, I went with thermal properties. So a brief look through some of the thermal properties, actually after another movie here. So here's the Australian Broadcast Corporation.
A cure for cancer is the holy grail of medical research, but it's still a long way off. Meanwhile, there are many new cancer treatments in the pipeline. One of the most exciting and imaginative new developments of the last 20 years is currently being trialled on our canine cousins.
Tucker, you want to go for a walk?
dogs in the world. Not only does Tucker have a faithful master, Pen, who lets him roam and swim to his heart's content around beautiful Lake Gaston in North Carolina, he's also had a reprieve from almost certain death. Tucker has a malignant tumor on his thigh. Surgery helped for a while, but the tumor grew back and the cancer spread to his chest. Not that Tucker's even noticed.
Boy.
At the 11th hour, Ken learned an experimental technique that offered his dog a slim hope.
I was very concerned about him because I've had him a long time and he's been my buddy. I felt that if there was a chance that he would could have a recovery, that would be great. However, I also felt that if it didn't recover and they could learn something from doing it, it would be worth it.
To get the experimental treatment, Tucker had to come here to the Veterinary College at North Carolina State University. It was actually a trial for a novel new medical procedure that, if successful, could dramatically change the way that cancer, especially the solid tumor variety, is treated in people. It targets a great clinical problem, how to administer anti-cancer drugs without sickening the patient. Powerful drugs like doxorubicin are proven cancer killers, but the most effective doses also threaten the heart.
Tibble looks smaller today, you think?
Yeah, I think it's decreased considerably since the last treatment.
What they'll attempt today is to give Tucker a potent dose of doxorubicin, but it will be packaged inside microscopic capsules of wax or lipid, known as liposomes. Liposomes aren't new. They've been used for 20 years or so, but the problem has been how to get them to their target deep inside the body and then release their cargo. Fortunately, tumors have a structural weakness that medicine can exploit. The blood vessels that wind through them have leaky walls. This means that liposomes can pass out of the blood and accumulate inside a tumor. What's more, researchers here recently learned that raising the temperature adds to the effect.
There's no question that heating the tumor in conjunction with giving the liposomes further opens up these pores in the vessels, allowing more liposomes to get into the tumor. So that's a big step forward.
But getting the tiny capsules safely inside a tumor is only half the solution. At nearby Duke University, oncologist Mark Dewhurst has been trying to persuade the liposomes to give up their contents once they reach their destination. In test after test, he could only get them to release a slow trickle of the drug, scarcely any better than a straightforward infusion. Mark teamed up with materials engineer David Needham to see if they could build a better liposome, one that would release its drug fast and at just the right temperature.
But the trick is to find a lipid that melts just above body temperature so that when it's injected into the body, it's still solid. It has to be impenetrable and solid at 37 degrees body temperature, but weak at 41.
Because liposomes are much too tiny to glimpse, let alone manipulate, David started experimenting with larger bubbles of lipid, trying to find a formula that behaved just the way he wanted. It took him 10 years to discover two particular oils that, when mixed, produced a unique microstructure. A capsule solid enough to carry a drug, but with a built-in quick-release mechanism.
The solid structure resembles a soccer ball. When that soccer ball melts, the first to melt are the stitches in the soccer ball. And that melting of those boundaries creates the permeability.
In the test tube, heating the new design liposomes by just 3 degrees made them give up their contents in a burst, releasing 50% of the drug in a record 20 seconds. But would it work just as well in the body? That's where Tucker entered the story. He's only the fourth dog in the world to receive this treatment. A rotating microwave device will heat the tumor to 41 degrees, hopefully enough to concentrate and release the cancer drug. As the liposomes begin flowing into his veins, Tucker's heart reacts.
Oh, his heart rate's going up with the infusion. It's gone from 60 to 74.
Everyone holds their breath as Tucker's rate peaks at 124. There's a real fear that the liposome package may be too toxic. The crisis passes, and an hour later, the patient makes a groggy return to the land of the living. In the weeks to come, they'll learn if the cancer drug reached its target. But in experiments with mice, the new liposome design has already delivered extraordinary results.
We actually get about a 30-fold increase in drug delivery compared to free drug, and about a 4-fold increase compared to other liposomes. Instead of having just growth tonight, we actually cure us. And that's a big difference.
2 days after the procedure, Tucker isn't up to chasing squirrels yet, but Ken and Phyllis can already see an improvement in his health.
That lump has gone down so much.
Yeah, it's almost back in the normal.
Assuming that no problems surface with the dog trials, humans will be the next trial recipients of heat-activated liposomes. If all goes to plan, locally advanced forms of cancer, like cancer of the breast, prostate and cervix, that at present are difficult to treat, will feel the greatest impact of this novel medical weapon.
So that introduces a few of the people as well, and I'm sorry I didn't bring enough tissue to pass around. So all right, so hypothermia and liposomes. So where we started here was, again, getting back to some of the mechanisms. Hypothermia itself has direct cytotoxic effects, and it's synergistic with chemotherapy and also with radiation therapy. And that's what this whole hypothermia program has been about. There are not many programs left because it's not been that effective. Radiation oncology departments tend to have it, you know, as some kind of adjunct. The problem is you can't heat cells high enough temperature in the body to actually kill them. In a incubator, you can get to 48 degrees, no problem, all the cancer cells die. But it's not been possible. Of course, the physics of this is, you know, there's blood, there's a heat exchanger, and all the rest of it. So the idea was maybe chemotherapy, or maybe introduce some liposomes. The blood flow is increased, the permeability is increased, liposomes extravasate, as we saw, more drug delivery, higher therapeutic effect. If the liposomes are thermal sensitive, though, and actually release drug at the temperature which you can heat to now, drug is released, more drug, maybe more therapeutic effect. So, you know, we have these kind of goals now to couple a drug and a device together. So the new concept then was rapid triggered release. So here's a... Again, images of a tumor at 34 degrees with a fluorescent dye, fluorescent liposomes in here, and they don't come out at all. If you heat it to 42, then you get this this effect of heat on the vasculature, and no heat, then you get permeability. And so the new cartoon here, you know, hide in lots and lots of papers on this again, is that we've got the permeability in the non-heated region, but in the heated region it gets even more, and you get more liposomes out. And that would be another... increased delivery, adding on to the traditional way of doing things. So the thermal sensitive liposome then, I just put a few of these slides together, was more in the appendix again. If we're looking at thermal properties, the permeability to water and small molecules increases at the phase transition due to grain boundaries. And these are some of the boundaries that we've seen. These are the that's the soccer ball that I put up. But a lot of these liposomes have got that faceted microstructure. And when we looked at solid monolayers, gas bubbles made of the same kind of stuff, solid lipid, we saw these grains and grain structure. So that's the underlying structure now of this composition. And if you want to see what this thing feels like, then this is a one molecular thick layer of wax on a 20 micron size gas bulb, and it feels like a plastic shopping bag. Mm-hmm. And when we do mechanical analyses on this, we find that it's like a, there's the grain structure. We find that the, probably won't go away. Oh yeah. So we find that it has a shear rigidity, a tiny little bit of shear elasticity, and then it flows. And it flows by movement across these grains and grain structure. So it's an intergrain slip that occurs, and that goes with temperature, and it's more of a kind of friction thing of these boundaries. So people have seen this in 1972, that radio-labeled ions get out, radioactive ions get out, and now drugs get out of these boundaries. But it wasn't fast enough. It was never fast enough. And so what I did was include some lysolipid. We did some exchange experiments, and we put lysolipid in the bilayer, cool it down, and then the next time you warm it up, maybe the lysolipid leaves. So this is the facilitating component now, is a phospholipid with one leg that's more soluble in water that can get in here, but maybe it'll come out. And actually, after several experiments that we did with a graduate student, what we think happens now is that this, you know, now we're getting back to more kind of physics and chemistry bilayers, that this micelle forming material actually stabilizes pores, we think, at these grain boundaries.
How
so that's the. 10 mole percent, somewhere around there. And so I said to Mark, hey, Mark, I have an idea. So with lysolipid in solution, the boundaries melt first, causing MPPC to leave or form these defects at the boundaries. This makes the membrane more leaky to encapsulate the drug, and if it's released in tumor, we get more to kill tumor cells. So Mark was a little bit happier. He wasn't ecstatic, but he was a little bit happier. So drug release. If we look now at some of the data, the percent of drug that's released now as a function of time, as a function of the MSPC concentration, which is monosterol phosphatidylcholine. So with none, this is basically the release of the drug. It's very little at 41 degrees, which is the transition temperature I'll show you in a minute. But as we add more and more lysolipid, it comes out in basically, you know, a few seconds. That's with increasing MSPC. So if we take that 20-second time point, then you would, you know, measure each one of these initial rates, and you get lots of drug out at about 10 to 12 mole percent, and that's in the commercial formulation there. So this is the all-important temperature dependence. So this is with the 10 mole percent in the bilayer, 30 degrees, not much released, 37, not much released, 39, 40, 41.3. So these phase transitions are very precipitous, and even with the lysolipid present, it's got the same hydrocarbon chain, the same head group, and so it doesn't perturb the transition that much. It's in solid solution. And so we end up with a very sharp transition of 40, 45 that starts to come back. So we've kind of got a peak, and we'll see
you
that.
You still have the polyethylene glycol changing.
Yeah, and that's actually part of the mechanism too. I think that even helps to form these pores. But it doesn't itself create the permeability. So it's a combination of the lysolipid and the PEG. So if we look at that 4 minute time point then, the percent of drug release now is 100% but 41 degrees. These hyperthermia people were stressing out to try and get temperatures in this range to kill the tumors by thermal deposition. But now they only have to heat to 41 degrees and they're a lot happier. If we look at these liposomes now, this is the heat-sensitive one, and it's now in the clinical hypothermia range, releasing 100% of its drug. 37 degrees body temperature, here's the choice of lipids that I talked about in that movie. Now this one is the doxyl liposome. So I said, how do we improve doxyl? Well, this is the doxyl liposome not designed to release drug, even at these slightly elevated temperatures. And just as an aside, this liposome and its patent portfolio were bought by ALSA from the company Sequoia for $850 million. And then Johnson & Johnson bought ALSA for $12 billion. So that's the kind of money available in this kind of business for things that don't work. But, anyway.
How much did you get?
I didn't know I would get anything.
So it's not available.
No, this is now been, yeah, well, you know, it's like I said, 25 years of research, 20,000 papers, 4 companies, you know, 2 products, and not much going on there. So, again, this is the tweak, you know, in materials, yeah.
So, at this temperature, the composition of the drug doesn't get changed.
the drug doesn't get changed. No, this is only, you know, it's only 3 degrees above body temperature.
Still physiological.
Yeah.
What happens if there's a problem? For instance, if the patient has a fever.
Has a fever, right.
Yeah.
Then you might not get it.
But can you put like a vasodilator inside the vesicle together with the drug and then so then, you know,
it's hard enough getting
like
the
that,
it's,
yeah.
It's been hard enough getting the drug in and tested now. It's taken 8 years to get to this point. So it's wide open, you know.
What about a metastasized tumor?
Then we do whole body
feeding
and we're thinking about that too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a bit more difficult. So there's lots of great ideas here.
So with the whole body heating, the assumption is that there'll be higher concentrations in the cancer cells than you're not.
I'll show you the basis for whole body heat, although that's a lot more difficult.
How deep does drugs go?
I can show you that in a minute too. These are all great questions.
What is increasing the temperature beyond 41 degrees to a drop?
Well, the permeability has now gone down. Because, in fact, I'll show you this. If we look at this liposome, then it releases drug here like this because that's where the boundaries are. When those boundaries disappear and it goes liquid, they don't exist anymore. And now you're dealing with the permeability of a liquid bilayer at these elevated temperatures, though. But it's vastly above what you would get, you know, without this little tweak of the lysolipid. Now, the interesting thing for the biophysicists was this is the drug release curve, which is maximum at the phase transition of the lipid where there's a maximum in the boundary area. But the drug starts to be released, and we've got permeability for diphenyanides and small ions too, on the shoulder. So this area under this curve is the mass of lipid that's melted. So here we've got hardly any lipid melted, and we've already got permeability, which, you know, led us to think that really this is boundary permeability happening. And in, you know, this case, it goes up, comes down for the drug, and once you go past this range where the liquid is now present, there's no boundaries, and you just get the bilayer permeability. So then we looked at the you know, cures cancer in mice, and we didn't really believe it because the first time we did it, we cured all the mice. So there's a lot of things here that I'm not going to talk about, but, you know, we're looking at half-lives, extravasation, tumor blood flow. I'll show you some growth delays. We didn't. There's other things that are in the appendix. So this is tumor volume on the flank of an animal over time, and you just let the tumor grow, and it grows to 5 times tumor volume in 10 days. If you give free drug, the accepted chemotherapy, at 5 milligrams per kilogram body weight, which is the maximum tolerated dose, then you slow that average growth down in 10 or 12 tumors by 2 days. If you now give a control 42 degrees C, no drug, it goes out to 18 days. So this is the effect of hypothermia. Some tumors disappear, but then they grow back. The average is now 18. And if you combine free drug, which is approved, hypothermia, which is approved, some tumors grow really quickly, but others take a long time to grow, and the average is now 22 days. Here's the $850 million liposome, showing that drug does get out. Tumors do disappear at a pretty rapid rate, really, over a period of 10 days. But then they all grow back. But the average lifetime now is 35 days out to 5 times tumor volume, including the heat. And then this was the result we got. So all the tumors disappeared out to 60 days. None of them grew back, and said, how lucky can you get?
Yeah.
And a quick story, I ran across the road when I was 13. I got hit by a car. I stood up to try and get my shoe because my ankle was broken. And the first car to stop coming this way was an ambulance.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's been happening my whole life. You know, I want to cure cancer. Okay, I just did it. So, anyway, so there's other things about this though that are not as clear. So, the new paradigm then that I want to kind of leave you with, there's the last few slides here, is that the liposomes come through, they can leak out. You can turn heat on, they can leak out even more. But now, because the release time is faster than the transit time, we get drug release in the bloodstream. And the drug release time matches the transit time through the tumor is faster. The local delivery now doesn't need extravasation to get out into this tissue, into this perivascular space. It can happen here. And what do these drugs now see? They see this endothelial layer. And so local delivery, we found that half the drug was bound to DNA in the tumor within the first hour. And so here's the, now we're starting to explore the mechanism. Here's a an analysis, or this is the kind of video I'm showing you of, these are fluorescent red cells, tracer bullets going through those blood vessels. And so that's what, that's 0.4 millimeters per second in the tumor. And then this is 6 hours after we've given this treatment. It's just dumping the drug. It's 200 times slower. So we start to see vascular velocity, you know, blood velocity shut down. And this is pointing now to a an antivascular mechanism. For normal vasculature, it has a much smaller effect. When releasing blood in, releasing drug in the normal vessels, it didn't have as much an effect as this. And in some, you know, the blood vessels completely disappeared over 24 hours. This is a thrombus. So it points to an antivascular mechanism, possibly coagulation cascade or inflammation, but just in the tumor vessel. And therapy appears for antivascular as well as antineoplastic. This is an anti-cancer drug, but it's also apparently killing the blood vessel cells, all due to material science. So, you know, I want to take us back to that.
What is this drug actually? What is the drug idea?
It's doxorubicin, Adriamycin. It binds to the DNA, and it also is a free radical producer.
Yeah, and that's what may be doing to the non-divided cells.
Yeah. So, it, you know, it's killing the endothelium. So, when we looked at other tumors, though, again, human tumors in mice, they all grow pretty quickly. This is volume versus time. With heat, they all grow. Some are affected. With the liposomes, without heat, they all grow, maybe a little bit here. And then our treatment, 1 hour, you just inject the liposomes, heat for an hour, and then these are the results. Then these tumors were still pretty aggressive. This one showed some efficacy. This one was the fatter that all, they were all cured, you know, like 3 years ago before this experiment. So whether the tumor had changed or the guy that did it had changed, who knows. But that wasn't as effective. And then the prostate cancer one showed efficacy. So there's again a lot more details about this in the appendix.
So what was different about, you showed us one example where it worked perfectly.
Yeah, yeah.
And now you show, so what's different about these than the ones that were
biology.
Well, sure.
That's the short answer. We don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. But we did look at things like correlating it with oxygen concentration or necrotic regions. We looked at, this is all in the appendix, we looked at the amount of drug that was deposited, the sensitivity of the tumors to the drug. It's very complicated. But anyway, you know, it did outperform any other system. This isn't a treatment either. This isn't like come in this week and we'll give you the drug, come in next week and we'll give you the drug. This is just one shot, one heat, and see what happens. So we're nearly done. So heat first, kill tumor. So this was something that, again, might be good for modeling. We can take MRI contrast liposomes that contain manganese, and we did what we normally do, achieve thermal steady state, and then give the liposomes. So the tumors are already hot at 41. Then we could either give the liposomes first to preload the tumor using that extravasation effect followed by heat, or we could split the dose into two, do the first thing first, give the liposomes, let them accumulate heat, and then give the second dose. So these are tumors, or MRI images of a tumor, and here's a catheter. So this is just a model system where we actually have a heating catheter. We wouldn't do this in the, they wouldn't do this in the clinic. Of course, I'm in mechanical engineering, and I'm talking about clinical things here, but they wouldn't do that. So here's the MRI movie of the tumor's already at 41, 42 degrees with this catheter, it's all heated. The liposomes are given in the bloodstream somewhere, they accumulate to the tumor and they accumulate peripherally. So, you know, drug release accumulates in the periphery, vascular supply is derived from the periphery. So many of these tumors, as we saw in that other kind of cartoon earlier, all the blood vessels are functioning now in the periphery and a lot of the tumor is dead in the center. Well, if we did the other thing, which was to give the liposomes first, they accumulate throughout the tumor and then you turn on the heat here, then there would be a gradient in heat away, and the liposomes at 41 degree release temperature are actually following that gradient. So the gradient in thermal conduction. And then this is the last one where you get the accumulation here, and then you give the second half and you get the more homogeneous distribution. So that's that. So, you know, which one produces growth delay? A, peripheral, B, central, or C, you know, homogeneous distribution?
Peripheral, but it would depend on the tumor.
Exactly. Well, it turned out the peripheral delivery. And we also got more drug in the peripheral. We got 20 nanograms per milligram here. So when you give it first, you know, it can leak away. I mean, it can not circulate as long and that. But it turns out this peripheral delivery. So this is something clinicians want to know now. And this is what we did first anyway. So there's some modeling here. You know, you go from an MRI signal to an actual concentration material. So last couple of slides. Potential applications would be in all these cancers. Of course, this motivates engineers now to create new heating devices. We've got clinical trials going on in liver with a, I'll show you the device in a minute, and breast cancer and prostate cancer. And so, yes, we're in humans. Here's the prostate with a catheter that heats the prostate. This is for benign prostate hyperplasia, but I'll show you in a minute how you can heat the whole prostate. In the Duke, they've created this home-built RF phased array device for breast cancer, and the women that came in were, again, they're very brave people that come in and do their trials, and they call this thing the booby jacuzzi. Because they heated the breast, the lady's lying on the bed here, and she's having the breast.
Some sort of microwave?
Yes, a microwave radio frequency heater, or an annular phased array, or the little thing for Tucker here, they've got something for humans too. And then this radio frequency ablation, you heat the center of the tumor to 80 degrees centigrade, but the temperature profile drops off, and we say, well, put liposomes in here and maybe get the barren roots, which often grow back. And then, so you all want to know how Tucker's doing. Well, when he came in for his first treatment that we didn't see, he had a 65 cubic centimeter tumor, a softball-sized tumor on the side of his leg. And when the movie was made, you know, the tumor looked smaller today, don't you think? Well, it was only 13. And then the next time he came in, it went down to 5. It's basically scar tissue out here. And so this is back in, you know, the year 2000, 2001, and so now he's dead, actually. So he, but he died of old age, not of cancer. So quick summary then. So using this design methodology, we can engineer biology, maybe. And here's our scheme that we might try and find ourselves in and go through the process. We might want to look at a microcellular level and a nano level, understanding the material behavior of these things. A problem nature has would be engineering pathology, if you like to call it that. Bio-inspired solutions for nanomedicines, the thermosensitive liposome I talked about, and then additional lysolipid to create this rapid release. New paradigm would be release in the bloodstream and then a antivascular as well as anti-cancer, and then our little temperature-sensitive liposome. So the learning objective here was learn how to use the design methodology to forward engineer solutions to problems nature has, maybe, you know, or change the changes that occur in composition structure as properties and performance. And so the example I kind of used here was, here's Farsh Gilai at Duke. He's in surgery and biomedical engineering, and he takes stem cells out of fat tissue, and he can convert them into anything. He can convert them into cartilage-forming tissues or nerves, and we mentioned that last week, and then it re-implant. So this is the kind of bio-inspired way of solving this problem of fixing your knee joint. And that, take the analogy now, can we fix sickle cell disease by changing that hemoglobin genetically or with polymers or some other way of doing that? Or you can do this. You can just replace the offending part with another piece of material that still gets the job done and puts it back, you know, so that it still performs a function, but it's not really a bio-inspired solution. So do this at the microcellular and nanomolecular level. And like I said, find yourselves on this scheme if you can, and talk to me if you want. The last thing would be, here's all our stuff here, the cure, the new technology, the diagnostic, a new liposome, oxygen binding release, specific binding, driven motor, light capture. These are all things that you can model with the physicists and the biologists. Salt water separation going in here. Maybe tumors are cured, gas handling, biosensors, micromachines, biophotonics, new strengthening materials, this kind of stuff, low-energy desalination plant. Like I said, father cured, grandfather cured, gas transport diseases, artificial muscles, electromechanical systems, optical displays, implants, fresh drug. So those will be the results of where you would fit in and do your modeling if you can do that. So then there's another appendix of what sickle cell disease, malaria, all this kind of stuff. And acknowledgements, lots of people in my lab and Duke Medical Center, veteran clinics and things. And that's the end. Thank you very much.